It's time now for another episode of The Crude Life, the most trusted voice in energy today. Join us as we step into the Cathedral of Capitalism, the amphitheater of ethical energy and arena for environmental innovations. Every week, the world's leading commanders of crude and guardians of gas share their expert insight and authentic analysis on topics of tomorrow and lessons from the past. Ladies and gentlemen, I invite you to start living the crude life today. Jim Willis, Marcellus Drilling News. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you, Jason?
Not too bad. MarcellusDrilling.com, is that the website, or is it MarcellusDrillingNews.com?
No, it's just Marcellus Drilling. I didn't want to, you know, hey, four extra characters, some people's fingers would fall off typing it, so we just go with MarcellusDrilling.com.
That's what I thought. I had to make sure before we went forward on that, so... Let's talk a little bit about what's happening out in the Marcellus. I believe that there's some pipeline news going on. At least that's what I've been hearing. And then I also want to ask you about the Shell plant, if you know anything about that. But the MVP pipeline, what's happening?
Well, some really great news, actually, with MVP, Mountain Valley Pipeline, which... people may or may not have heard about in your audience, but it's a natural gas pipeline, 303 miles long, that stretches from Wetzel County, West Virginia, sneaks down through most of West Virginia and then into Virginia and through most of Virginia as well. And it terminates in Pennsylvania County, Virginia, which is sort of in the south central part of the state, or southwestern part of the state. And that pipeline... I should know this offhand, and I don't. The year that it began to be built, I believe it was 2018 when it began to be built. It was supposed to be done within a year. It will flow molecules from the Marcellus and the Utica, 2 BCF a day, 2 billion cubic feet a day, once it's completed. From the Marcellus and the Utica, and flow it down into the southeastern part of the country where there's a bunch of customers that really need it, not the least of which are some electric power plants that use natural gas in order to generate electricity, and also some, you know, various utility companies that want to resell it to their customers. So it was supposed to be done within a year and at a cost of about $3.5 billion, and it has been how many years, you know, since 2018 that it's been, quote, under construction, and the price has ballooned to $6.5 billion. And the anti-fossil fuelers that have been opposing it, which is the Sierra Club, and there's a few other green organizations, I call them big green groups, that have been responsible for bringing lawsuit after lawsuit against it, challenging various permits that have been issued for it, federal permits. And somehow these groups have gotten, they got appointed a 3-judge panel at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, that I affectionately call the Fourth Circus. And these 3 judges, 2 of them are Obama appointees, 1 a Bill Clinton appointee, consistently have ruled against Mountain Valley Pipeline in lawsuit and in case after case. By my count, there's been over a dozen cases challenges that have been brought against various permits, things like for endangered species and permits that allow it, you know, to go through wetlands and over creeks and things like that, through a very, very tiny portion of Jefferson National Forest, and things like that. So these judges, and I believe 12 out of 14 cases have ruled against Mountain Valley Pipeline, and it has held it up for years. So more than a year ago, West Virginia Senator, U.S. Senator Joe Manchin started to really focus on this and try to draw attention to it. He thought he had a deal. I'm grossly summarizing all this, but he thought he had a deal with his fellow Democrats that if he voted in favor of the Inflation Reduction Act, that's a laugh line, right? It was the Inflation Inducement Act, but he thought if he would vote in favor of that monstrosity of a bill that includes, among other things, a tax on methane for oil and gas companies, that if he threw away his vote on that and voted for it and gave Joe Biden a big win, that in return he would be able to get his fellow Democrats to vote in favor of completing Mountain Valley Pipeline. But as soon as he cast his vote and turned around and tried to collect, his party abandoned him, and they refused to support him and actually pass the bill that would be required to get this all done. So if we fast forward, and there's another senator in West Virginia, Shelley Moore Capito, and there's a congresswoman in West Virginia, Carol Miller, and they worked with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on the Fiscal Responsibility Act 2023, the quote-unquote debt ceiling bill, right? And a huge part of the provision in that bill was language to complete Mountain Valley Pipeline. So with the aid and assistance of Capito and Miller, and of course Manchin was supporting it as well, that got included in the bill. The bill got passed in both the House and the Senate. There were still a number of Democrats that voted against it, but we had many more Republicans to counterbalance that. And then Joe Biden actually signed it into law in early June. Well, that provision does a couple of things. One of them is it tells any agencies that need to issue permits to finish Mountain Valley Pipeline, they must issue those permits within so many days. It also literally rips any jurisdiction over Mountain Valley Pipeline away from the Fourth Circuit and hands it to the D.C. Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. So with those things now in place, the people that, you know, Equitrans, the company behind Mountain Valley Pipeline, filed a request with the court to dismiss. There were two final lawsuits that were still sort of, circulating around there. The third was third time around that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had issued an opinion saying that this project wouldn't harm any endangered species, and it was overturned two previous times. And so now it's the third time at the Fourth Circuit. And a second one was the third time at the Fourth Circuit for a permit from the U.S. Forest Service that would allow the pipeline to cross over 3.5 miles of the federally owned Jefferson National Forest, which, by the way, Jefferson National Forest is 1.8 million acres, 2,800 square miles. So passing 3.5 miles through there is a nothing burger, right? It's absolutely nothing. And yet, twice before, the Fourth Circuit has rejected that permit, and it's there for a third time. So MVP said to the court, hey, you need to now dismiss those two cases. And it filed with FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, for permission to restart the bulldozers and to finish up. And I should have prefaced all this, and I didn't, by saying 94% of this project is already done. It's already in the ground. It's already covered up. It's only 6% where it goes over certain streams and rivers and goes through wetlands, i.e. swamps, where it hasn't been completed. And so they've asked FERC to be able to finish the final 6%. Last Friday, they asked that early last week, and then last Friday, FERC gave them the go-ahead. So we're just, we're waiting to see when the bulldozers begin. But that's sort of a high-level view. It took an act of Congress to actually finish this pipeline, which should never have to happen, but it has. And now it will go forward, although there are still a few wrinkles, that are out there. The green groups filed motions with the Fourth Circuit saying, no, you shouldn't dismiss those two final cases. They should move forward. In other words, they're challenging that aspect of the debt ceiling law. They want to get that overturned. They're trying to overturn part of the debt ceiling law by challenging what that law says. That law instructs the Fourth Circuit, if there are any remaining lawsuits, you discharge them. They're gone, right? And yet they haven't done that yet. So, we have this little thing kind of in the background. It's kind of an irritant, and we hope that pretty soon they'll see the light and they'll actually do what they're supposed to do. But aside from that, construction, I'm hoping construction probably began today, today or tomorrow, when everyone's on vacation looking the other way. That's the way I'd do it anyway.
What markets does this open up?
Well, it opens markets for drillers, for producers in the Marcellus and the Utica. So the 100% of the molecules that are going to flow through this are going to go from north to south, and they're going to go from basically mostly that tri-state area of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio, where they kind of come together. West Virginia has its northern panhandle. It kind of sticks up in between Ohio and Pennsylvania. That region, that's in sort of the eastern Ohio region, mm-hmm. is very much called what we would call a wet gas region, because there's a lot of NGLs that come out of that region. But there's also a lot of methane that comes out. And this pipeline is all about methane, so it's not going to flow NGLs. It's just going to be methane. CH4 is going to be flowing down this pipeline from that region largely southward down into Virginia and beyond potentially.
Is there any value added or capture of the flaring that can come out of this if once this goes through, potential?
Potentially there might be, but I'll tell you, Jason, most flaring is now captured. We don't do a lot of flaring. There may be a little bit here and there in certain remote regions, but we've really got a handle on that in the Marcellus and Utica. That's largely a thing of the past, unlike, in oil areas. Methane is, that's what we do.
Yeah.
We capture methane because we want to sell it. So we're not going to burn it if we don't have to.
Yeah, I almost forgot that there's really no oil in the Marcellus. It's just gas, isn't it?
There's some oil.
Okay.
But largely in Ohio.
Okay.
Most of the crude production that happens in the Marcellus Utica is going to happen in Ohio. And it's going to be kind of in the northern part of the play, of the Utica play, where Aubrey McClendon originally set up camp and thought that he was going to crack the oil code, mm-hmm. in Ohio. There definitely is. And it's good, but it's nothing like what you have in North Dakota, And we're not ever going to, produce like that when it comes to oil.
Gas, on the other hand, Marcellus, that's, the prolific.
Yeah.
What are some, is there any value added, I guess? I'm used to, some of the shale plays where you have, you know, the value added, you know, whether it's feedstock or whatever comes out of the kind of the byproduct of the drilling. And do you have any of that up there, or is it just, you know, pretty much go right to market?
Well, we have a number of, when you talk about value added, so we have a number of
I think that's the term, plants.
Yeah, we have a number of processing plants. So when this stuff comes out of the ground, well, for instance, where I live and work out of New York State, near the border with Pennsylvania. So I think I've told you this before, Jason. I live and work in occupied territory. Mm-hmm. So I'm behind enemy lines, right?
Kornheiser country, we call that.
Yeah. Right. But I live about 15 miles from the border of Pennsylvania, Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania. Susquehanna County produces more methane than any other county in Pennsylvania. And it's just 15, it breaks my heart, it's 15 miles away, you know. So on this side, you know that there's plenty of gas on this side too. But having said that, in the northeastern part of the play, Pennsylvania anyway, it's dry. You know, a little bit of water, you know, produced water will come out of the ground over time, and you know, and there will be a tank on a pad, you know, and a truck will show up once every week or two, you know, to empty that. But that's it. I mean, it's basically pipeline ready when it comes right out of the ground. Not the case in southwestern Pennsylvania, near Pittsburgh, you know, in that northern panhandle area of West Virginia and in eastern Ohio. There's a lot of NGLs in that area. So we have to clean it up and we have to separate it because those NGLs can be quite lucrative. So, and you don't, you know, just want to send it down the pipeline just to burn it off. So we have processing plants, you know, we have cryogenic processing plants that will separate out the methane, and then fractionation plants that will further separate the NGLs, the heavier hydrocarbons, into their components, ethane, butane, propane, isobutane, you know, those things. And then those things can be, excuse me, can be sent down a pipeline. There are various pipelines out of the area that go to different locations that carry the NGLs, you know, Y-grade pipelines. And those pipelines will take care of selling, you know, either getting that to a market where it can be sold, or in some cases when it goes east over to the Philly area, we have an export facility over there, and some of that actually gets exported.
Wanted to check in with Shell as well. I think they're still Royal Dutch Shell.
Actually, they are not Royal Dutch Shell anymore.
Oh, they're not. Okay.
No, they're just old plain Shell.
They're just old Shell. Okay.
They moved out of the Netherlands. They had enough of those taxes and those regulations, and they moved out of the Netherlands. Their headquarters is in the UK.
Okay.
And they dropped the Royal Dutch part.
So they're just Shell now, and thank you for that. I always called them Shell, but I always thought in the back of my mind, you know, it's actually Royal Dutch Shell. But anyway, so Shell opened a ethane cracker plant, $6 billion or so, something like that, and then some neighbors got mad, and then I think I read that there might have even been a lawsuit to try to stop it or slow it down. Do you know much about that? Do you have any updates on that?
Yeah, Shell created this, built this massive ethane cracker about, I don't know, 20-some miles from Pittsburgh. It's in Beaver County, sort of northeast of Pittsburgh. And it takes our abundant ethane supplies from this region, from the Marcellus and Utica region. And it, you know, as ethane crackers do, it cracks it and turns it into polyethylene, which are these, you know, little little plastic pellets. And then that plastic can be molded and formed into any of thousands of different products, you know, by manufacturers. It got going last fall. It really, you know, after, I don't know, it had been under construction for like 5 years. And it finally got going last fall. But there have been episodes where they've had to do flaring there because they had to shut things off. And so they had to flare what was in the stack. And, you know, it's loud and it makes the night sky like daytime, you know, like orange. It's a concern for some of the people that live in the area. It's been, you know, you talk about being subject to an anal exam. I mean, I hope it's okay to say that on your podcast. But this plant has been really under the microscope, right, from day one. And so there are a number of, again, green groups that have come along and have said, well, we require certain testing, you know, to make sure you're not pumping, you know, too much of certain things into the atmosphere. And so there's been fence line testing, there's been on location testing, there's been outside of the fence line testing. To boil it all down, Shell's had a few issues with this particular plant, with the startup. It's, you know, I want to say, yeah, you know, the aunties are, you know, just hammering them and looking for any little thing they can. On the other hand, they have to do it right. And we can't afford to do this wrong. For things to slip by, for there to be problems and, you know, ongoing problems and issues. Supposedly there's been 10 or 12 different times when, because of flaring and emissions, they've exceeded certain levels that they weren't supposed to exceed with stuff going into the atmosphere. And a notice of violation is called from the DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection in Pennsylvania. It's issued notices of violation to them for that. And so, as far as I know, it shut down maybe, I don't know, a month ago or so, and they wanted to, you know, sort of get things really in hand so that these things wouldn't keep happening. And I have not heard, I think they were due to restart, but I haven't really heard that, that things have fully restarted yet at the plant. So let me take that back. I'm just looking at May 25th. They agreed to a certain fine from Pennsylvania, $10 million. And they were supposed to be restarting at that point. So I have not heard since then. I haven't noticed anything in the media, that says, hey, there have been more problems or anything like that. So if they are restarted, then things are going well. I'm just not sure. I'm not 100%, you know, up to date.
Yeah. Your background primarily is media, correct? You're not a former oil and gas owner, are you?
No, I'm not. Actually, my background is marketing and on the political side of things. I don't know if I ever told you, Jason.
Okay.
But when I was a kid, and I was in college, I did an internship in Washington, D.C. And after that internship, I was then on staff, and the internship and the staff position were at the White House during the Reagan administration. So I worked, my physical office was in the old executive office building. But I used to run errands, you know, over into the West Wing periodically. And I had friends over in the West Wing, you know, that would give me tours when my family came to town and cool stuff like that. Stuff that, you know, doesn't happen anymore, I'm sure, because of security. But, but you know, going back in time, I was...
Darn it, Clinton, you ruined it for all of us. Before, right? We're blaming Clinton for that one, aren't we?
That's,
come on now.
Right.
I mean, if you're going to drop the word, you know, anal, I got to drop a Clinton joke. Whoa!
There,
okay.
There you go.
Anyway, so you were the
political guy for a long time, so...
So you were... not only did you kind of observe it, but you kind of, you know, osmosis, you know, you were a part of it in a roundabout sort of way.
Yeah.
I'm glad you actually told me that. I didn't know that about you. So you have, you know, Marcellus Drilling News, which, and how long has that been around?
That started as a hobby in 2009.
Okay, 2009. So you've been doing this for about 15 years, but... My point is it's turned into a journalistic, a article, you know, a place for trusted news, and you've been able to make a living on it and et cetera type of a thing. So with your political background and your oil and gas covering and just kind of understanding the industry, if you will, and knowing kind of how journalism and public opinion and everything works, because you're able to create a company, so you do. What should oil and gas glean from this? What did Shell do wrong? What's happening? You know, is it a public relations thing? Is it a technology thing? Is it just a NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard? Because everything seemed to be going along so good, a $6 billion, you know, economic development, and everybody seemed to be okay. And then all of a sudden you started seeing this, like, smear campaign, because they were talking about, oh, local neighbors upset. And you know, when the media brings out the word local, oh, they mean business. They mean business. So you know, from your experience, what did you see from this?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, like, what, you know, quote, what went wrong here? And could they have done anything differently than they did?
Well, that's a good question there too. What could have they?
My observation was, it was a very well run project, and Shell is not some, you know, fly by night. I mean, they're an international organization. They're not even an American company. At least, you know, their headquarters. And they had really, really talented people working on this. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I would like the answer to that question too. We're always going to be held to an impossibly high standard. You know that, in the oil and gas industry, and the rules are always going to change in the middle of the game. You know, that's just the way it works, and we have to come to terms with that. You know, we're going to be questioned. Any little minor foible, whatever, is going to be greatly magnified. But we also have to be big enough. We have to be man enough to stand up when there are problems and say, "Look, there's problems here," and. You know, and we're not going to try to gloss over this. We're going to step back here, and we're going to evaluate this. We're going to do a root cause, you know, analysis on it in engineering terms, and we're going to figure out what went wrong, and so that this never happens again. And you know, there has been a little bit of PR problem here in my opinion. So Shell had Ben Van Beurden was Shell's CEO for a long time, and he was really into renewables and all this nonsense, my opinion. I mean, renewables aren't nonsense, but, you know, suggesting that a company like Shell simply stop drilling for oil and gas and do renewables instead, that's nonsense, you know. And the new CEO that came in, Wael Sawan is his name. When he was talking about the Shell cracker, you know, in Pennsylvania, he made this comment that the problems that they've been having at the plant, he referred to them as quote unquote technical niggles. Right, he's a Brit, so niggles is a, you know, it's a British word. But you know, in my mind, that's kind of a PR faux pas. You know, there are people that live near that plant, and they've been seeing the night sky light up, and they've been told that they're, you know, at times breathing things that maybe they shouldn't be breathing. That's not a niggle. And so, you know, let's be honest about these problems and let's get them fixed. You know, I mean, that's my solution.
That's my next question is, we've had this, you know, the great crew shift and the great leadership shift and all these different things that have happened. And what I'm starting to see more and more is kind of a disconnect from what traditionally was pretty strong relationships. And when you take a look at an oil and gas company, they traditionally had a good relationship with their local community. Maybe not communities outside of where they drill, but at least where they did their business. Man, they would just come in and build roads and make sure the fire department had the latest and greatest equipment, and they would spend money, you know, I mean, and rightfully so, you know. And so that's where we're seeing it up here in North Dakota, where there's starting to be this pushback too, and I don't think the Permian will ever have pushback, because as soon as the drilling goes away in the Permian, that whole Odessa Midland goes away. I mean, everything, because that's the only thing keeping that town there. But in places where there's like diverse economies, starting to see this. And so I don't know if it's the public relations, if it's a reality, or if it's just that disconnect where the new leadership is, you know, I don't know, busy on social media, so they're not, you know, going to the community barbecues like they used to, or whatever the case might be. But I don't know if you have a comment on that, but I'm seeing some new leadership, and then there's definitely some difference dynamics being developed. How's that for a phrase, I guess?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that is happening here and there. But on the other hand, I still do see, you know, and I get the press releases, you know, that, you know, so-and-so, you know, driller has just invested, you know, $50,000 in local community, whatever, you know, fire company and things like that. That still does happen and is still happening, at least here in the Marcellus and the Utica. I am seeing it. But what I'm also seeing is that overall, because the number of rigs is going down, and the number of permits is going down, there's just less drilling. So there's less money to spend in the local community as there once was. And so I don't know that...
You know how that story goes, though. Then what ends up happening is the state doesn't get as much money because they were expecting more drilling money, and then there's less grant money. And it, you know, it has kind of the... I call it the reverse ripple, where you have this reverse ripple that happens, and then that's where I always thought it was interesting that oil and gas would become the bad guys during that. Like, oh, okay, so you're mad that spigot turned off? Okay, all right. So turn ours back on then, you know?
Yeah.
But, okay. What else is happening out there? Okay, so we got the Shell plant, and that's kind of tune in tomorrow, huh? One of those. That's really kind of what's happening there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I guess my sense is, since I haven't been seeing anything lately, that they've probably addressed the issues that needed to be addressed, and we're on a better path. half at this point than we had been for a little bit. And that's not to say it wasn't a disaster to begin with. You know, these are not, I mean, they're important issues. They're, you know, important things that have happened that need to be addressed. But neither has it been, you know, a complete disaster. They've been producing, you know, these plastic pellets and things have been going fine, you know, in many ways. So hopefully we're at the point where we're not going to have any more flaring episodes and things like that happening.
Well, my advice to the industry, I guess, my two cents and my takeaway, as we segue into another topic, is that when I start seeing, you know, being better neighbors in headlines, that's concerning to me, because if it's a technical issue, well, then technical issues in the headline. But if it's being better neighbors, that's a little bit more of a PR issue. And that's what I kind of took away was, boy, I'm seeing that too much in that. So I kind of put that in that, okay, the crew shift happened. Keep an eye on that type of a thing in back of my mind. But, well, Marcellus Drilling News, what's the top story, man?
Well, the top story is the price, I guess, from my perspective. And, you know, the price of natural gas has just been in the doldrums, and it's been hard to get it elevated again. It's been going up a little bit, which is good. You know, the Henry Hub price over the past quarter, it's gone from the low 220 range to maybe, you know, almost flirting with 280, but that's just not high enough. And you know, unless and until the price goes up, we're just, you know, we're not going to see a lot, you know, a lot more drilling anywhere. And, you know, I guess, you know, another top story, you know, important issue that continues to play out here in the Northeast is that aside from MVP, from Mountain Valley Pipeline, we have no new pipelines coming online. We can't get any built. It's done. It's arrested. And so we're at maximum capacity. We'll get a little more capacity when MVP comes online, true, and that'll be great. But for the most part, our capacity is maxed. And with a maxed capacity, you know, there aren't new opportunities for a lot of new drilling. You know, new drilling happens, obviously, because of the decline curve. And shale wells, you know, start to play out, so you have to drill some new ones to replace them. So there's that sort of thing that goes on, and that's great. But we could be doing so much more if we had more capacity. We have a small drama that's playing out and has for years. I don't know where it's going to go. Once upon a time, New Fortress Energy announced that in Northeast Pennsylvania, which happens to be landlocked, there is no, you know, doesn't share a border with the ocean, they were going to put in an LNG facility in Northeast Pennsylvania. And from that facility, which is in the Wyalusing area, they would transport by truck, special truck, and or specially outfitted rail cars. They would transport the LNG produced there to a port that they plan to build on the bank of the Delaware River on the New Jersey side. And the port happens to be at an old DuPont dynamite factory site. And yet, you know, organizations like the Delaware River Keeper are hollering about how this is dangerous and is going to blow up, right? It's dangerous for the river. But you know, they they bought the land, they pushed a bunch of dirt around, and they've never built anything. They had a permit that allowed them to build, and then the permit expired. And so just recently, New Fortress announced that they want to renew that permit, and they do want to pursue this project. So that'll be interesting. So maybe we could get it. It would be a small LNG export kind of situation, and it would be going from from the Delaware River downriver from Philly. But there's so much opposition to the trucks. I read articles in local newspapers about, we don't want those bomb trucks, coming through our area. And then recently the Biden Department of Transportation the Trump Department of Transportation had issued a permit that would allow specially designed and very safe rail cars to transport LNG. But then the Biden administration came along not long ago and reversed that. And so that's gone. That special permit for New Fortress Energy, it was a one-off permit for them. That has not been renewed. It expired. It wasn't renewed. And the Biden administration's in no mood to renew it. So I don't know. Where does this go? Who knows? It would be great if we could get it up and running, because it would be sort of a beacon, a light, a pilot for how we could do this in other places too. But I'm not a betting man, but the odds are not all that great, if you ask me.
Do you have much offshore? I mean, you're not that far from the coast, and I'm just kind of curious, because I did interview a guy that was, he was in 2000 and what was it, 19 or 20 or something like that. He was right before COVID happened. And within 1 year, 90% of his business went from decommissioning pipelines to wind energy, basically. It was such a shift out there on the East Coast with some of the underwater pipelines and then wind turbines and stuff. I was just wondering, do you guys have much of offshore drilling?
The only offshore that I'm aware of is for things like wind. I'm not aware of any, oil and gas drilling offshore off from the coast of New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia. I think that's largely concentrated in the Gulf because of the continental shelf. I think it's probably too deep out this way for stuff like that.
Yeah.
Would be my guess, but I'm not familiar with it if it does exist.
No, I'm not either, actually, at all. And that's why I was kind of curious, going, man, I haven't heard of much out there. But once you start going inland a little bit, you can find some activity pretty quick. So.
Yeah.
Well, how can people check you out, support you, and do all that fun stuff?
Well, they can just come to the site. It's MarcellusDrilling.com. There is a little box in the upper right-hand corner. It says Get Daily Headlines. So if you just, if you only have a cursory interest and you just kind of want to keep track of the headlines, you can get my daily email. It's free. But if you try to click on any of those headlines to read a full story, you'll get hit with my paywall. So say you have to be a paid subscriber. And that I try to keep reasonable. It's $7.95 a month, or save a couple of months, it'd be $79.50 for a year, which saves you 2 months worth, about $15 and change. And that's, that's the best way. Just in passing as well, for those who are in the industry and have, they're in the pipeline industry and have concerns around compressor stations and things like that, I also write a monthly column for a magazine called Compressor Tech 2. Which is put out by KHL Group, and it's a monthly magazine.
Oh, I never miss it. Yeah. Compressor Tech 2, it's called, right? Yep.
Compressor Tech 2.
Yeah, yes. Never miss it. Never miss it. That in my meetings monthly. Yes.
But I said that to say that the column I write, I actually review, you know, quick hits of the news from all the shale plays, not just the Marcellus Utica, but I do the Bakken, I do the Permian, you know, I do the Mid-Continent, you know, the Eagleford, the Haynesville. I sort of keep track as I'm in my daily, you know, trawl of the news. When I notice things, I just sort of tuck them away, and then once a month I put together a column for that magazine, and it runs in that magazine every month.
So you're like the USA Today, that one page of all the different states put into one page. You're like that of different oil and gas shale plays.
Exactly, and it's called Shale Play by Play, the column in that
magazine. I've always, you know, I've wanted to do a show like Around the Horn, you know, not Tony Kornheiser, but the other one before, the lead-in show with all the reporters, and I call it Shale Play USA, and that's what it is. You just go around all the different shale plays and do a check-in or have people talk about the different topics from different things, because, you know, there's a lot of activity happening on a regular basis, and there's a pretty good-sized audience of people that want this information. Who is your customer primarily? I mean, is it a news hound, an oil and gas investor, somebody who just, you know, works in the industry? Who do you know who your average customer is, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, all of those.
Reader, I guess reader would be the right word.
Yeah, subscriber. So, you know, I look at the people that want to pay me money for it, and where are they coming from? And I would say that the two largest audiences are, number one, people that are in the business, right? So they're from these producers, these drillers, and or pipeline companies that have business in the Marcellus and the Utica. But also, I have a very large audience of landowners and rights owners. They want to know what's going on, and they want to know, is it coming close to me next? I publish a list every week of the latest permits that have been issued and where they were issued. State by state, you know, for all three of the Marcellus Utica states. And so people want to keep track of that stuff. And then, you know, a smaller portion, but still meaningful, are investors, you know, regulators, just as sort of a mix of, I even have people that are very dedicated and committed anti-fossil fuel people that pay me money and want to read what I'm writing. I guess, you know, because they want to keep an eye on the competition, I suppose.
Your audience being large enough of landowners to be noticeable like that, because when we started the ESG University to kind of, in a roundabout way, combat ESG, I guess, because we're not a fan of it, but at the same time, we wanted to be more of an educational, so not go at it as hard, try to have some balance, you know, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But we primarily found most of our subscribers came as landowners, because we glommed onto the Summit Carbon Solutions story from pretty much a landowner's perspective on the under the guise of G, under transparency, you know, G. And that's where I noticed the bulk of my subscribers came were from landowners. At least that's what, when I surveyed them, they're like, we need to keep, because they were not in the state. These were like out-of-state landowners that needed to keep tabs on their South Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, North Dakota, Nebraska land, because, you know, inheritance wise, but you forget that 47 people sometime own an acre.
That's right.
And they have a vested interest in that 1 acre because it produces a lot of money for their family sometimes.
That's right.
But okay. Marcellus Drilling is the website. Marcellus Drilling News is the name of the brand. Mm-hmm. Jim Willis or James Willis, which one do you prefer?
Jim.
All right. And what's the best way someone gets in touch with you? Through the website, I imagine, or do you give out your email?
Yeah, I give out my email. If people want to email me, it's jim@marcellusdrilling.com. We'll be right back.
The Crude Life, the most trusted voice in energy.